that operators increasingly preferred because operators are better able to engage with portfolio companies when it comes to negotiations. They are better able to advise on strategy or international expansion.
So hi everyone, so welcome back to the podcast. So today we have an amazing guest with us today, Alexander Piskunov, who is the partner at Khan Ventures. So hi Alexander. So my first question to you, Alexander, is, so what did being in the UK teach you? I generally ask this question to like understand the experiences of my guest, and it's just a good way to start the conversation. So yeah, do share like what is your take on that?
Well, look, I mean, I am originally from Russia. In Russia, we have an education which is heavily focused towards, the hard sciences like mathematics or physics. And in the UK, when I first came, I was quite young, I was 12 years old. And in the UK, they focus much more on the social sciences, right? So like economics, political sciences, philosophy. And when I was first, entering the job space in investment banking, what was really interesting for me was that they don't really care as much about, the hard skills, because they understand that, of course, those are important, but you can teach them on the job in the 2 or 3 months. But by focusing more in terms of your degree and education on the social aspect, then you are able to, maybe sometimes engage with clients on a different level or add something really meaningful to the team. And as a result, there is less of a focus on the financial specialists, even in investment banking, although there is still quite a few of those. And in terms of entrepreneurship, what interests me, about UK is that despite all their problems, coming from Brexit, coming from often case the lack of meaningful direction, whether they want to focus their markets and innovation activities on Central Europe or on North America or on their colonies, they have still managed to build up a great ecosystem which supports startups from idea stage all the way to IPO, and it is focused on a bunch of technologies, not only in deep tech, like for example in biotech or in cybersecurity or in AI, but also in the more traditional industries, like for example in the financial technologies and stuff. So it's actually quite a good mix. And for both entrepreneurs and VCs, UK, I would say right now it's one of the best markets to start their ventures in, even though obviously it's more competitive and it does mean that you have to sell your story much more convincingly.
That's extremely interesting that, you went from Russia, then you went to UK, and then now you're working at so many different VC funds. So my next question is, like, what's your take on AI, which is emerging as, like, one of these technologies that is getting a lot of funding of late? It's becoming all the craze. So, like, what's your take on that?
Well, look, I mean, AI, obviously the huge market, but you have niches within it which are growing even more rapidly. Like, obviously, you've heard of, guys like OpenAI or Bard in the generative AI space. From my own perspective, I would say that where artificial intelligence has the greatest capability of making an actual contribution is in those industries where the previous wave of tech innovation has not really made a dent in terms of how the operations are structured or, how is the data managed. And AI, in its nature, can really transform all those traditional processes, because given the right set of initial inputs, even, the middle managers of those corporations can arrive at meaningful decisions to make their activities much more meaningful on the global scale. And as a result, in the corporate space, there is often a question of, who adopts AI first? Because if you manage to do it and you've managed to change your product based on the insights gained by AI, then it leaves quite a few of your competitors in the dust. But at the same time, what a lot of investors, for example, are not understanding is that right now, even though America and to a lesser extent, UK do lead the race for AI, there's also a huge market, which is China. And in the Chinese market, a lot of companies don't even need to be international because they can just cater to the local consumers or corporate buyers. And as a result, not many of the innovations get leaked onto the open press. And problem with AI is that, if it gets significantly regulated in one country, like for example, the States, where there's actually quite a lot of talk right now about, the ethical side of AI and how not to turn ChatGPT into the Skynet. You, as a US, risk losing your first mover's AI mantle to China or to the other markets. And once you lose that advantage, it's almost impossible that you would catch up. So I think that, AI, obviously a very interesting field, but in terms of investment, a lot of funds or family offices who do not really specialize on AI are trying to get into the hype. And I think that for them down the road, unless they manage to do proper due diligence and actually support their portfolio companies beyond just giving them the financing, they would quickly find that it's going to be very difficult to make successful exits. So I would say that, any investor should really pick his own niche and specialize on it because not only it's good financially, but it's also good reputation-wise, and you would be able to build much more beneficial relationships with your portfolio companies as well.
And I think that last point you made really drives home, like you have to pick your niche and you have to stick with it. And so that last few sentences that you mentioned about how to support founders beyond financing. So what is your take on that? Like, how do you support founders beyond just the financing, beyond just throwing money at them? Like, what can you do to better support these founders who are going through like some pretty tough times as founders, or like maybe even successes as founders. So, like, what can you do to better support them?
Well, look, I mean, ultimately, the way that a VC fund or any other kind of investor should engage with his portfolio companies depends on the stage of those portfolio companies, right? So if they're early on, then usually they need help with developing their MVPs, so a minimum viable product, finding product to market fit, maybe, hiring additional C-level members, like, for example, a CTO. Or, just initial product validation of fundraising. While at the later stages, like for example, at Series B Plus, it's much more about facilitating international expansion. So it could be, so targeted M&As in a market where they're not traditionally strong in, but they really do believe in their continued operations in that market. Or maybe it's through helping to sign major contracts with large corporations if their startup is in the B2B space, or maybe once again, it's fundraising, but from top-tier funds all over the world. Or, even if they're later stage, then maybe it's helping them to prepare for an IPO or a SPAC procedure. So building up their board of advisors, building up their board of directors, and making sure that the accounting standards are up to scratch. So in my own personal opinion, I think that ultimately for a VC, yes, it's quite important to help out the winners in his portfolio, but a VC's job is to be a portfolio manager, right? So he cannot afford to spend too much time and too much money just on a single company. So it's about picking the right, maybe four or five or six companies out of a portfolio of 20 to really focus their attention and contacts on. When it comes to the potential crisis that do happen in the startup world, VCs also need to understand that sometimes there could be a choice between, investing in a company and doing a bridge round where basically the valuation would not increase. Or, not investing and letting that company go bankrupt, so basically losing out of on all of your initial investment. And this is why For example, especially in the time of COVID, quite a lot of VCs had to make long-term investment decisions, which did not really bode well for their financial operations over the short run. And this especially translates to the companies in deep tech or in hardware, because normally those companies, they do need more time to go to the market, more financing, more resources spent on R&D. If you compare them to the more traditional businesses in venture capital, like for example, financial technologies or micro mobility or marketplaces and similar fields.
I think my biggest takeaway was to pick the right companies and to focus on for portfolio support. Like just picking those 4 to 6 companies and then putting all your efforts into those companies and helping to support them better. So my next question is more like, so you'd mentioned about fundraising a bit. Like, so how do you build momentum during COVID? Like to fundraise for your VC fund or as a founder? Like, what could you do to like stand out and like to step it up a bit?
Well, as a founder, obviously it's much easier for the serial entrepreneurs, right? So those who have done it before, they know how to sell their product. They have a network from which to fundraise, perhaps, the angel financing from. But if you're a first-time entrepreneur, I would say that it's very important to really work on selling your story and your vision, and being able to understand, what kind of problem are you trying to fix, and how exactly is it, personal and unique to you? Because in that way, you would not only be able to appeal to your potential investors better, but you would also be potentially much more successful in selling your product to clients. And also, it's quite important to work quite a lot of time on doing your pitch deck, right? So thinking about all the various aspects that go into it, from understanding the markets to clearly showcasing the unique selling point of your product, selling your team and its experience, expertise, and many other similar things. So unfortunately, there is no golden way for success, and ultimately, entrepreneurship is much more of a game, trying. Often failing, but drawing the right lessons and doing it better the next time.
So my next question is, so I'm just curious, like how do you sell your story and vision? Like what is your take as a VC? Like how can a founder better position themselves to sell their story and their vision to a VC?
Well, look, I think it's very important for founders to really do due diligence on their VCs, just as VCs do due diligence on founders. And by due diligence, I mean having a look at their previous investment portfolio to understand, what kind of similar companies in the same field did the VC previously back. Then maybe even, talk to those companies to understand, what red flags there were in the communications or in portfolio management process. Maybe to also have a better understanding of, on which specific criteria do those VCs make their own investment decisions? Because ultimately, VCs have their own agenda, and sometimes they're not as willing to disclose those points directly to founders. So you have to do quite a lot of your own digging, which doesn't only, take the form of talking to the portfolio companies, but you can also, see what kind of image the VC is trying to build in the digital space. You can see what kind of, for example, reports his company produced in the field that they're specializing on investment in. And I think that, it's also important to understand, who exactly is on the other side of the table from you in the negotiation, right? So investors, they take many different shapes and sizes, right? So in the beginning, deal with mainly the angel investors who invest in you almost purely, based on your own vision and the degree to which they feel they're similar to you, or perhaps, were similar to you at a certain point in their previous time. And then as you grow, as your startup grows, then you deal more with institutional guys, right? So the VC fund, the corporations, the private equity firms, and each of them have their own criteria through which they're assessing not only your performance, but also your future financial project. So do make use of the vast amount of information which is available online to better build on your vision, your pitch deck, and all the related materials like financial models, your one pages, and similar things.
That was some really great advice for the audience. I think one pagers and pitch deck is like super important. So my next question is, now let's dive more into the VC space. So you've worked at three different funds as a partner. So what could you share about to somebody who wants to start breaking into VC space? Like, what background is necessary for them to enter the VC space, and how important is it to be an operator?
Well, look, I mean, for example, when you compare venture capital to private equity, in private equity, you, when hiring, normally prefer people who know how to do financial modeling, who have previous investment banking experience, who have deal exposure in the field. And venture capital, on the other hand, there is not as many clear-cut cases. So you have guys who are, as you mentioned, operators before, know how entrepreneurs think and are better able to formulate the right terms during negotiations. You have consultants who have a bird's eye view of many different industries. And normally, a VC, no matter how narrow his investment focus is, normally it's still quite broad to incorporate investments in companies across different industries or across different markets. So there will be an opportunity and need for people who are able to disseminate the right information quite quickly and to draw the right lessons. And then you also have guys, with a more traditional financial background and experiences. And those guys are normally being employed in the growth equity fund, right? So where the company in which the investment is made is not huge yet, but it already has arrived on a clear growth trajectory. And it's much more, about scaling a product into product line or, scaling dominance in the local market towards regional dominance and things like that, rather than simply building an MVP. And as a result, the financial projections that this growth stage company has, they are much more meaningful and reliable. And there are things to analyze when you're looking at the balance sheets, the income statements, and similar financial aspects. So in venture capital, I would say that definitely there is no golden rule yet again, but there are some careers which are more meaningful than others when you're looking at the investment team members. When it comes to the partners, however, I would say that operators are increasingly preferred because operators are better able to engage with portfolio companies when it comes to negotiations. They are better able to advise on strategy or international expansion. And this is why you would find that many, many partners of big and mid-sized venture capital funds, they have previously scaled their businesses very successfully. And now they're trying to not only, advise and mentor the young generation of entrepreneurs, but also to make their own money doing so.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on like operators being more preferred as partners in VC funds. So my next question is more like Southeast Asia. So you're based currently in Southeast Asia. So what are some VC trends you've been seeing in Southeast Asia, and like what is the state of Southeast Asia VC, and like what could you say on that front?
Well, look, I mean, Southeast Asia, very interesting market for sure. It's not as uniform of a market as, for example, when you compare it to Western Europe or to North America. In that, in Southeast Asia, you have the developing countries, like, for example, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Cambodia. And then you have the more developed countries, like, for example, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan. And as a result, when it comes to, for example, the trends in the VC activity, you would find that quite a lot of funds, especially from the West, they are trying to make their impact investments in the emerging markets, While in the developed markets, it's much more about fundraising from the institutional investors. It's much more about, you know, supporting deep tech companies in those fields. And you would also see that, like, for example, previously, maybe 10 years ago, there was a big competition between Hong Kong and Singapore as to which would be or which is, you know, the predominant financial hub of Asia. And Singapore was, you know, often case viewed as secondary to Hong Kong. But over the time, Hong Kong has increasingly been closer and closer to China. And as a result, you know, it's not such a great destination for many Western and American investors or startups to locate. And as a result, you know, they're increasingly moving to Singapore if they have not already. While Hong Kong is a hub for activity by the Chinese investment funds, family offices, corporations, and startups. So it definitely has its own niche, but its importance and relevance have really shifted over the past few years.
Yeah, that's some interesting insight. So I wanted to wrap this up with like, so you are now like doing a lot of this podcasting, trying to develop your personal brand and stuff. So how does one start from scratch, like building their personal brand as a VC? Like, what advice do you have just to close off this conversation?
Well, look, once again, I think it's very important to know your own niche and your limitations, right? So when it comes to building the public image online, when you're an entrepreneur or an investor, I think it's good to understand very clearly, for example, when you're working with portfolio companies, how exactly would you be assisting them when you're trying to build the image online, you know, where would you want to share your views on, and what exactly is your audience? Because in this day and age, there is just so much information available online that if you do not have the right strategy to sort of sift through that noise, then you're likely to, you know, divert your time to the activities which would not be as meaningful, even though they would be quite interesting for you personally. So obviously, you know, once again, you know, time management skills are important, and it's also quite important, you know, to spread those public relations activities across multiple different platforms, like for example, YouTube interviews or, you know, podcast recordings or reports, because each of them, they have a different potential audience. And to build a truly, you know, meaningful and recognizable brand, you really need to understand what exactly are their needs and how best to cater to them effectively.
For sure, I think podcasting is a great way to build your brand, not just for the podcaster, but also for the guest. And so, yeah. So, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. And do share how the audience can get in touch with you, how they can pitch to Khan Ventures, how they can learn more from you. And yeah, now is your stage to just share more about you and how they can get connected.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that the best medium to connect with me would be on LinkedIn, quite active on LinkedIn. Feel free to drop me a line. I'm more than happy, you know, to share my own experiences or, you know, fundraising or product scaling advice. Because previously to starting in VC, I have been active in many different fields. I've been an operator. Back in the UK, I worked in investment banking, I worked in private equity. And I think that, you know, for entrepreneurs, it's also quite important, you know, to understand what kind of lessons would they be drawing from each of their own previous experiences, whether they, you know, whether they're work-wise or personal experiences, and to scale those experiences to better pitch to potential clients or to investors. So, happy to share my thoughts and to engage with your audience through here on a more personal level.
So, if you're listening to this podcast right now, I have an open opportunity to reach this audience. So, if you want to reach college students and freshers interested in startups and venture capital, And just in terms of the demographics, the age of 18 to 22 is the highest age demographic in India, and US are the two largest country demographics of listeners for this podcast. Email me at bizpodruhi@gmail.com. So thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode, and hope you've learned something new.